Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today in studio we have two special guests. Ted Becker is the owner and broker of RE/MAX Results in Moreno Valley. Having started the company in 1989, he's also been experienced at practicing law, being a general contractor, and operating different types of developments. Mike Novak-Smith is one of the leading REO agents in the entire country. Mike's in the top 1% of all real estate agents nationwide, and is experienced in REO short sales, bankruptcies, asset management, and negotiating. Mike specializes in REOs in Riverside and works with Ted's brokerage. Welcome both of you back.
Thank you.
Just off mic, we had talked about the year 1989. I got into the business in 1980, and the way that colored my thinking was that interest rates, you know, are extremely high, and you know, there was a long time that I thought that that was normal. In 89, you really came in right at the peak year of optimism. So everyone would have had the mindset of 05. You couldn't do anything wrong in real estate. And so you joined the fray, and then 18 months later, completely different world. Did you find, you know, Ted, first of all, as the owner of a brokerage, my first memory of being at your company, I was speaking to your group. And you had a sales meeting, and it happened to be when REOs had kicked in, probably 08 or 09. And there was sort of like a sharing of results for the month. And so it was Mike Novak-Smith, 32 sides, Mary Lou, 2 sides, Joe, 1, and thanks everyone else for showing.
And that's so somewhat accurate.
Yeah. And then so 89, you had a lot of people in the industry doing well, and by 92... you had an impact that was very different. So how does a broker owner deal with that transition, especially with no experience?
Well, I was fortunate in that I started in what was probably a good time, but I don't even know that I knew it was a good time. All I knew is that I was building the business. So I don't think I really realized until about 92 or 93 that things were tough.
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest thing is there's no blueprint. So in 89, you think, well, this is the way it is. By time 92, you're looking at something that's a blank sheet. You're going, this isn't like it was.
What happened?
Yeah, and what do we do? And the same thing for you. Mike, as a broker, you step in 89, you know, farming would have been the thing. You know, you have a normal idea of, like, I can just get listings and all that. And all of a sudden, by 92, that's not the game at all.
Well, the REOs, when I started doing them, you couldn't give them away. The RTC called a Century 21 office I was at and said, hey, we've got these REOs. We're only going to give you 5% commission. Nobody wanted it, but I did some quick math, and I figured, gee, if I do that, we get to eat and pay our house payment, pay the car payments, because there wasn't much else going on. So that's what I started doing.
So it wasn't like I better go after these REOs because there's going to be plenty of them. It's just that no one wanted them at the time.
Yeah. Part of it is it was in those days, if it paid less than 6%, nobody wanted it. And they were hard. It was a different game, but it was something to do to keep busy, and that's why I did it, you know?
You know, there's been a lot of transition. I mean, you think in an industry from 89 to now, it is a quarter of a century, which is a long time, I guess. But there's been a lot of changes. And one of the starkest one is how the REOs, how different they were treated 92 to 96 versus 2008 to 2011, let's say. Because I remember HUD auctions being a big deal. And we were able to buy properties at a big discount and, you know, feel like we had a margin. When, I guess, the information age hit, it just seemed there was a lot more availability of information. That was partly how they marketed things, is that a lot more people knew of the deal. And, you know, you being the REO agent, how was it different dealing with the lender-owned properties during this last cycle versus the 90s?
Well, it's the internet now. In the old days, you worked off of fax machines and phone calls. The advantage now is you can handle many more properties using the internet and the web-based systems, but there's a lot more control from the selling side. So I think in the past when those HUD auctions and VA auctions were going on, a lot of it was the inventory accumulated because they couldn't manage it properly. They didn't even know what they had. I mean, I would get properties assigned to me. They sat for 3 years vacant. Nobody even knew where the file was. Once you got everything computerized on the internet, that stopped. And I think the deals, the spread, as you would like to call it, are not as good as it once was because now they know exactly what they've got at all times.
Well, I think they know what they have all the time.
Usually,
and that's the problem is they don't always listen to your input. And no, I've seen those things. We have boot camps, so we take people out. Mm. This was a perfect journey of an REO. So the first time we go there, so there's 60-day spread between three visits. We go there, and there's a house that's an REO with an empty pool, and that's it. Next time it has water in it because the neighbor put the hose over the fence, and it's got kids in the pool. The next visit, they got bored with that, so now it's a half-filled pool, green slime, and now they constructed a skateboard ramp on the driveway. And then now the lender, I wish I could have just taken pictures and sent that to the lender and said, who knows what's next?
Exactly.
So there's some liability owning this stuff too, but I think what happens is with a push of a button, they can feel pretty comfortable on the value and, you know, all that. It may paint an inaccurate picture.
Well, it's a lot easier. If you had 100 REOs, even if you're the agent, you can look at several computer screens and you can see where everything is at, what part of the process it's in, and they have the same ability. The one you're describing, I've been out with asset management people. I've seen them fire agents from the car for that. They get there and there's a green pool and they don't know about it. You're going to be gone if they catch it.
Yeah,
that's intolerable.
It's a tough. Mm. It's actually a tough business on your side because behind you there's got to be just like an investor, you know, we want to make an offer. We're not the only one that wants that property. You can't be the only one that wants the REO listing either.
Right. Yeah, you better do it right. There's plenty of other people that want it.
Yeah, and that's almost like when we talked about, you know, that was really almost the numbers that day. You were closing dozens and they were closing one. So it was the only way to make a living of substance. What do you do when not everybody can be an REO agent? And you've got that kind of a downturn.
You hope really hard. No, all you can do is encourage. And, you know, generally speaking, in almost any market, there's almost always enough for the people who are working.
Okay.
So it's a matter of motivating people to be out in the market, farming, looking for deals, knocking on doors, all of which all of us salespeople tend to resist because it's uncomfortable and we don't really want the rejection. But those are the people who survive. So it's a matter of getting those people to do that. Many don't. Many just drop out.
I would think a lot of your agents would have longevity, let's say, in the business. Do they have loyal clientele?
Yes,
okay.
Generally. You know, it's hard to say because I don't interact that much with them about individual clients of theirs, but I think, generally speaking, they have pretty good client loyalty. Not so many these days, investors. You know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there were a lot of investors in the market. Today,
right.
It seems a little flat. I think prices have been pushed to the point where the investors have stepped back. So now it's almost a little bit of going back to the mom and pops and the real sellers.
Well, you know, when you're looking at charts, too, you have to think of not just what you're looking at number-wise. You have to think, what was it comprised of? You know, who is the buyer? So, yeah, you could look at a chart and say, well, sales really did okay. And then all of a sudden you find out that half of it's a hedge fund or a,
right.
You know, and then you find out, okay, when they're gone, then we have this, the gap is realize, and all of a sudden we look and say, okay, how are sales in general, and say between 2015 and 2014 at this point? I know 2014 wasn't so hot either.
2014 was not so hot, and 2015 so far is less hot.
Okay.
if that sounds right. We just discussed that this morning, and the truth is the numbers are down. And the numbers are down generally in the marketplace. In Riverside and Moreno Valley, the numbers are down overall. Whether they're down as much as our numbers are, I don't. I actually think our numbers are down a little more than the market, which is unusual.
Right, I would think that would
be. So I beat up on people pretty hard this morning in an office meeting that they better get their activity up. But and it's unpredictable. I really believe, if you want my opinion, lending is a big part of the problem.
Yeah.
We're dealing with young, untested, first-time borrowers who are literally run through the mill and cannot get loans.
It drives me crazy. There was the 100 economists got together, and I know they had to, at the end of the day, what were your conclusions? And they had to have the ear of people that make policy. And their conclusions were that because prices went up and because interest rates went up a little bit, there you had affordability problem and people could afford less house. And it just drove me crazy because it's like, that's one chart I look at and say volume of sales goes up as affordability goes down. It's done it in the 70s, the 80s. It does it every stinking time except now. So if it's except now, then it's got to be some other factor. And the other factor is you're telling people no that should get a yes a lot of times. And because they didn't land there, they did completely a disservice to an industry. They should have gotten in front of Congress and say, okay, Dodd-Frank, let's say it was well-intentioned. It has now become such a roadblock to getting a yes answer that people are either resigned, they're going to be renters, or it just is so frustrating to go through the process. And I don't know that that's going to... Is lending getting easier in 2015?
I don't believe so. We have a young couple. One of our gals has a young couple, 19 and 21-year-old, newly married, been on the job about 9 or 11 months. They have $90,000. Either from their parents, I assume, or from somewhere. They can put 20% down on a house. They cannot get approved for a loan because they have not been on their job for 2 years. Now, does that make any sense at all to turn down a 19 and a 21-year-old who are otherwise qualified? Now, I can't vouch for that because I wasn't involved in the actual loan, but that was what was reported to me. But it's those kind of decisions that are hurting the marketplace.
There's those decisions are, you know, that you hear stories about this, and then you know somebody that has them. When on the investor side, you know, we were busy doing hard money loans to people because there wasn't any other outlet for them. And one of the guys had, I don't know, probably $6 million, let's say. He had sold a bunch of houses, owned them free and clear, and he sold them all. And he has this pile of money. It takes 2 years off, so he doesn't have really any income. He doesn't care. Just goes and relaxes for a while. Comes back, and 08, 09 starts to happen. So he wants to re-up his credit line with the bank. They look at his paperwork, and, you know, you just don't have any income. Okay, so he goes to buy 30 free and clear houses. Comes back and says, okay, now I got $30,000 a month income. Yeah, but it's not documented for 2 years. He cannot borrow a dollar. And so I still have those loans at 9.9% interest because he couldn't get any lending anywhere. So the common sense answer is not even available. That's the problem.
I think Mike has the best analogy, the car analogy of lending.
Okay.
Well, so I've mentioned this before. If you take the car industry, let's say we wanted to go down and buy a new Mercedes today at $100,000. We could be out of there driving a car home by 5 o'clock. You take the same buyer and he goes to buy a $100,000 house in San Bernardino. 2 months from now, he may not have it. He'll be run through the ringer and probably be done with the whole process. That's the problem. If you put that same criteria on the car automotive industry, they would go bankrupt in a few months. And that's, you know, I think it's a pretty good comparison.
In other words, today we can't repossess the house. We can go repossess the car tomorrow.
Right.
But we can't repossess the house. The guy is still living there 3 years down the road, and nobody can explain that.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, the unintended consequences of some of these things. So you get very generous with lending. So that was, we did go too far. I mean, there's no doubt that went too far. And whoever was in charge of those decisions at that point, you know, whether you're president of the Mortgage Bankers Association, seemed like somebody should have stepped up and said, guys, this is not going to end well, not just for the loans we're making, but for the industry, because this is going to be a problem. And now we've, like a rubber band, we've gone way too far the other way, and we're having a really hard time getting back to what would be middle ground. And, you know, that's, I guess that would be the goal, is to see if we can get back there. Now, I just had somebody get a yes answer that surprised me. This is a relative of mine. He just got out of the service. So he doesn't have that income anymore. He has a housing allowance. He has a ride that's free to college. His wife got a job at Target and has had the job for 45 days, and they just got funded on the loan for $275. How is that? I mean, I'm happy they got it, but it was a head scratcher for me because she wasn't employed in New York because she didn't need to work. Wow. So, you know, there's that story where you just go, I don't get that one either. But
I think overall, that, you know, there are always stories, pro and con, but I think overall, just the tightening of the lending, there is no entry-level buying going on. And that, as our office in Moreno Valley has always relied in every downturn on entry-level buying because there's nobody below that. And this last downturn, literally, it's been very limited.
The entry-level buyer is generally what, under 30?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Okay.
Usually.
Well, now that brings up the whole other habit of that whole millennial generation.
Yes.
When we turned 30, we probably had already owned two or three houses and had been married 7 or 10 years. I got married at 17, so that's not really, there's no chart for that. But in other words, by the time I got to 30, I was a full-blown adult, understood, you know, real estate, owned several homes. You know, I was kind of entrenched. But that doesn't seem to be the norm now for somebody that's 30. And so it's a sea change, not just for lending, but habits of young adults.
Right. Well, I think some of the luster has gone out of the idea of owning real estate. Some of these kids as teenagers grew up with parents that were fighting to save their house. Maybe the parents were foreclosed on, and their uncle was foreclosed on. You know, there's things they couldn't do when they were growing up because we had to pay for the house payment. So I'm sure there's some of that. But it is very difficult for the first-time buyers. I think the big problem, too, is the self-employed people. It's very hard to get a loan now.
See, I thought we were invited back to Washington, D.C. We were on a panel, and there was all the billion-dollar hedge funds were at tables. And they were really after the clientele that I loan to. That's literally the clientele that they want to come in. Just like they bought up a ton of REOs, the next phase was let's loan to these guys were our competitors. So that's what they've been doing. And my comment to them was, you know, first of all, they said, well, you can, like a minimum is $5 million. Well, they're going to go through that pile of people in about a week.
Sure.
Then who's next? And so now they're doing one loan. But to me, they're chasing, they'll do one loan to an investor. So these guys that thought they were going to loan to 50 house deals at a time are now loaning to one REO or one, you know, doing one refi at a very reasonable rate because they can't place all their money. What they could do is place it to the occupant world. And that's what I told them in this panel. I said, to me, you should be busy writing a program for stated income or nothing down. And I said, you'll place a ton of funds. And I said, it'll be safe. It'll the payments will be made. And your business won't start with a B. Eventually, it'll start with a T, a trillion. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if they're interested in that. But to me, that's where the niche is that they should occupy.
Well, the part of the problem with that, Bruce, is if, let's say, they make that loan and we get back to the car comparison, you don't make your car payment 3 months from now, they hook a tow truck around it. They do a lot of those loans and they start to fail. They're probably 3 years out to get the collateral back. And I just believe if you're a big bank, there's a lot of things you can loan money on, credit cards, cars, and other items, and you don't have to play the game of the foreclosure process.
Now, is that time frame alive and well still? I mean, let's say I don't make a payment. I got a loan in 2014. I don't make a payment. What's the process now? I know there's more notifications, but it's got to be a year or less in California, I hope.
Well, I ask people all the time, you know, when we're evicting them or, you know, you knock on the door that first time after the foreclosure, I'll ask, when is the last time you made the payment? And I would say in the last 2 years, maybe I've heard 2.5 years, probably the shortest period.
Yeah.
They give them every chance in the book. A lot of them went through loan mods and other parts of the process, and then it all fails. So if you're loaning money, I could see their concern.
Now, by and large, we're through the pipeline, right, as far as REOs. You don't expect any boom in that, I don't think, from any residual pile.
Not with the current politics, no.
Okay, but you think but there, it's still...
There I think there's still, a lot out there.
There's okay. still a lot of homes out there that are upside down.
That is true.
I mean, have a question.
Okay, sure.
And I don't want to change the subject, but recently I read a press release, a company called GCAT Management Services.
Okay.
Purchased 5,400 loans from, I want to say Fannie or Freddie, right. or one of those, HUD. 5,400 loans. If you take an average of 200,000 loan, that's $1.08 billion.
Okay.
What would they pay for those loans? Do you think they would pay 20 cents on the dollar?
No, it's very competitive. It almost makes no sense.
How much would they pay?
More than you would think, honestly, because it's not like it's in an isolated thing. So honestly, you have a lot of billion-dollar funds, like a Carrington and all mm-hmm. that. Now it's for open bid. Just like a trustee sales. An appropriate comparison would be trustee sales. So every day you have, at the peak, how many hundreds of millions of dollars a week go to trustee sale in mm-hmm. California? And what were these hedge funds paying with all the money in the world? 95% of value. I mean, it's the truth.
Then, so do you think they're
yeah. overpaying for it because they want to place their money?
Okay.
Honestly, it's not like their deals because we know Carrington would be a for instance. Carrington met with us. They wanted us to be actively involved in helping them place their money at some pump. They started that division mm-hmm. and they went to the note buying business. And I was basically told that it's so competitive that there's a niche there that at least they're competing with other billion-dollar hedge funds, but it's still, they're paying serious money for that stuff, not the 20 cents on the dollar. It's not,
really?
Yeah, it's just not there.
But they're essentially buying the houses, because if you own the note, you effectively own the house.
Well, but see, then there's strings attached. Well, you don't yet, you have to foreclose, but really, with my understanding was that arrangement comes with a definite restriction on you can't foreclose on it for a certain duration, and the attempt must be made to do a loan mod. So really, most of those turned into loan mods, not foreclosures. I mean, we can tell that by just look at the foreclosure chart. That didn't happen. They didn't become REOs.
All right. Well, you've taken the entire wind out of my entire argument. But, but my assumption would be if you could buy it for 50 cents on the dollar,
well,
you would have a tremendous advantage as a hedge fund. You could keep the people in the house for essentially half their payment. Probably most of those people would make that payment.
Now, if
and
they
stay in the house for 5 years and maintain it and keep it nice. And
if they were buying it at 50%, it could have still represented 90% of value. Right?
True.
Okay.
True.
They weren't buying at 50% of value because if they could keep that money busy at that level over there, then what in the world would they do in spending billions of dollars at trustee sales at 95 cents on the dollar?
Agreed.
One at a time.
Agreed.
The only reason they showed up one at a time is they couldn't buy them in bulk.
But they can buy the notes.
Well, but Carrington, yeah, they do buy the notes, but it's you wouldn't want to participate.
You think it's 80 cents on the dollar?
I think it's more.
More?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. And I think it happens. It's human nature. Okay, we've got $1 billion here. We've raised a $1 billion fund. What do we do with it? And you sit there. People lose their jobs by not placing that money, and so they place it. Every day we go to trustee sales and go, why did they buy that?
No, I agree. I've seen many REOs where they just paid anything for it. They just wanted it. I mean, what do we got to do? We'll pay it. I see less of that now. A lot of these same people have no interest in it because they don't see any upside. That's what I believe.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, whatever they were doing. First of all, you know, that first chunk of $5 million, I mean, but if you really raised a significant amount of money and your goal was to buy several thousand homes, you were not too cautious about how you did it because you wanted to place money. So it took the margin out of everything.
So even smart people make mistakes.
They don't know that they were making mistakes. They were getting paid to do that job. So I think that was it was interesting incentive. It was placement. It wasn't mm-hmm. so much margin.
Right.
And I think that's it was an interesting time to be a competitor against that because the rules of engagement changed just like that very quickly. Wow. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. We will touch on more subjects when we come back.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.